Hello, everybody. Thanks for joining another episode of Fireside Chicago. I am your host, Tim Shum. I'm also the founder and president of Lucas James Talent Partners, a recruiting firm here in Chicago. Check us out for sure. We are now on Instagram and Twitter. You heard of it? We just joined there. We're probably a little bit late to the action, but check us out there. If you're an existing listener, you're a new listener, hit the subscribe button there. You're going to get access to all the future shows when they come out. You also see videos and clips of past shows. Go check that out if you haven't done so already. Today on the podcast, we have Scott Catoon. Scott is the CEO of Technori, the host of the Technori podcast, partner at Songfinch. He's also an active angel investor in town. We get into a ton of different topics. Scott's been a part of the tech ecosystem here in Chicago for the past 7 or 8 years. Really interesting insights. Not only is he very active here in Chicago, but Technori is on the coasts as well. So he gets access to venture capital firms across the coast, founders across the coast. He's just been in and a part of the scene for a really, really long time and has a great perspective. Ladies and gentlemen, Scott Catoon. What's up, Scott?
What's going on, buddy? How you doing?
Thank you so much for joining us. I'm doing good. We go semi-far back, maybe 4 or 5 years ago when I was like leaving corporate America, entering the tech scene. You had just kind of got involved with Technori, and then it's awesome to see where you've come and what you've been doing, the growth of Technori over time. But yeah, happy to have you on the show.
No, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We got a lot of stuff that I wanted to kind of get into, but you know, first for folks that maybe don't know Scott, haven't listened to the podcast before, just maybe a little bit high level on you and what you're involved with.
Yeah. So, I mean, like you said, when I jumped into Technori, I had actually used to go to Technori's all the time when I was in grad school, and Seth is a friend of mine and decided to kind of take the throne from him, if you will. And the whole focus of Technori from then till now has always been giving shining a light on startups and letting them get access to venture capital through a myriad of ways. It used to be on stage at an event every Tuesday of the month. We'd host about 500 or 600 people at Chase Auditorium, and 5 companies would pitch, and anyone in the audience was kind of there. A lot of venture people, a lot of accredited investors, hundreds of millions of dollars raised in these companies. Shout out today to my guy Cameo, Stephen Galanis. He actually launched on our stage June 2017, announced his $1 billion unicorn status today, the day that this is being recorded, at least. And ironically, a company that I ended up acquiring a stake in and now are operational in, Songfinch, was on that same stage. So I'm sure we'll talk about that. But the idea behind it was that people could come and learn from companies and hear the pitch and kind of get involved, whether you wanted to work for them or you wanted to invest in them or whatever. And then I had this crazy idea of linking up with Republic. At one point, I was thinking of turning Technori into a crowdfunding platform, equity crowdfunding, and met Ken from Republic and was like, you're the guy to do this. Like I'll invest in you, like, rather than me do it. And so we pitched this idea to WGN Radio to turn the stage event into a radio show where anyone listening could invest via equity crowdfunding and accredited could still invest, you know, traditionally. Somewhere around 50 million was invested by unaccredited equity crowdfunding. And as we turned into 2020, even before COVID, I was like, we are doing a podcast where I interview founders and people who are successful and kind of share a little bit of the journey. And I'm doing these pitch reviews where I'm listening to startups pitch. We should just do a video pod version newsletter and just like really trim it down. And so the last year, I did one today. I interview a founder who's equity crowdfunding. I hear the pitch. I ask some questions and I write a weekly pitch review on Substack that is the largest of its kind on Substack that also just raised a shit ton of money. Substack at a $650 million value. And so I write this pitch review on there, and it's got 50,000 plus people who read it every week, invest in these companies. And personally, I invest in a lot of these different companies. One of these I'm wearing right now, Grit Boxing, I invested in via Republic. You know, so that's kind of my jam, man. I talk to people like you. I talk to entrepreneurs on my pod. I talk to people like Darren Revelle and venture people. And then I interview founders and give them a platform. That's my jam.
Check it out if you haven't already. Technori podcast for sure. I think we're the same age, I think, or at least one
probably.
Or two.
Probably. I'm 36.
Apart.
I turned 37 in May, I think. I actually forgot how old I am. I don't
just
really
turned 37. I know when you get in your 30s, it's like you don't even want to count.
Stop.
Anymore.
I stopped. I don't think I remember when I ever, like, my birthday. I don't.
I feel like our kids are going to come up in a different environment where like they got the iPhone in their hand, they got like a VR headset on. I didn't really kind of like get exposure to the tech ecosystem in a business sense until like well after college. What was it for you that kind of got you into this space originally?
So like I was always a little fascinated, and I, you know, had a Facebook account when it was only colleges in 2004 at Marquette, and I got Twitter and, you know, all that stuff. I was always kind of interested in, and anything to me that can make me scale things faster and make me spend less time in meetings and that, I'm always for. So I was always kind of naturally gravitated to it. The content and tech, social and tech world, I was working in commercial real estate, hated my job, hated everything I was doing, and was writing this crazy blog on Blogspot at the time under an assumed name, where I basically just would rant about what I really either did say or wanted to say to the people I was dealing with on a daily basis, even waiting in line at Einstein Bagel in Lake Forest, and some asshole would come in and steal stuff, and I would say crazy stuff to him, and I'd write a blog about it. And it started picking up traction, and there was like 10,000 readers all of a sudden, and I was like, what the hell? So when I went to grad school, ironically, I was looking to go to become a lawyer, which I don't know why. I think it was just to like, it was not to be in court. It was like, I wanted to do deals in real estate and investing type stuff. And I just wanted to be able to do the whole thing myself. And I got, it turned onto a capstone project at Northwestern that was through a company called Big Frame, which eventually got bought by YouTube. And it was promoting what was kind of the first real influencer at the time, Mr. Guitar Man on YouTube. And the project was essentially bringing them to South America and try to getting involved with them. And I was like, boom, there's this whole digital world that's out there. There's an influencer world. And I ended up getting a second master's from Northwestern from Medill, which was on the media side, media and management. So I kind of had, you know, business and media together. And from there it was like, I'm going to become my version of what I think a business influencer can be. And I'm going to still do deals, and I'm going to be a deal guy, but I'm going to use media.
You're right. Zuckerberg's like our age. I was born March 16th. I think he's like March 20th or something. I remember being a sophomore, maybe at Purdue, when Facebook came out. And I'm like, what is this? I started reading like Inc. magazine, Fast Company. Somebody my age is like worth $1 billion already. That kind of opened my eyes to like, what is this? What do they know that I don't know? And that kind of started like an underlying passion. I got into the recruiting business and like never really touched it professionally. But it's amazing to see, you know, when you start looking under the hood, when you really understand how this stuff works, what people are doing out there and how they're scaling things so fast.
It's crazy. I was immediately hooked because to me, you know, I'm somewhat of an introvert. I actually started my first podcast because I didn't want to go to networking events and I didn't want to meet with people. So I just was like, I'll pick the 10 people I want to meet in town and I'll invite them on my show, because who's going to say no? And when it started picking up traction beyond just a tool, it was a utility. And then it became like an actual thing. And I was like, holy cow, people are offering me money to sponsor this. Like, this is insane. And, you know, now we sponsor the show with M1 is a big sponsor of mine. I've used the tool forever. I love it. Republic, obviously, all these groups. I'm just basically working for people who believe what I believe and like want to invest in cool founders and build cool companies and not have to do what I did in the real estate space, where I just wasn't happy. Like, I don't think people want to do that. There's stresses of starting your own job, which are inherent. And I don't think it's for everybody. I don't think everybody should or wants to do this, but for those that do, and there's a huge number of people, you know, I think we talked about this offline, like Cash Drop, Ruben Flores Martinez, who was on my show a couple of weeks ago, who come from a background, an immigrant background that like normally is ignored. And they're the people who are most likely to be successful as entrepreneurs, because their whole family history is essentially entrepreneurship, whether it's, you know, selling stuff on the back of your car or opening a shop or a grocery, like that's all entrepreneurship. You know, I think that there's not a lot of access for that. And so my whole point was, when I tried to get money for my business, no one was answering. No one could give a shit about me trying to raise money. And so I wanted to fix that. And I did it for myself. And now like the whole point is to let people who don't have access, like use me as an example, or use me to get promotion so that they can raise money and do it their way. Cause I think the future is going to be filled with creators and entrepreneurs, and that might be a plumbing company. It might be anything. And you used to say it's a small business versus a tech company. And now I kind of don't think that, because I think everything has a tech component to it, right? So that's kind of the whole thing right there.
I feel like there's a barrier of knowledge and transparency where, you know, I was riding a train to my recruiting firm that I had managed at the time, trying to learn more about investing and how tech companies got off the ground and things like that. Like, you really have to like listen to Technori, like research articles, like have mentors, build up your network to really truly understand how things work. And I just think you have an interesting perspective because you talk to Ruben, you also talk to Stephen Galanis, you talk to the founder that like maybe doesn't have a great idea right now, or maybe has a great idea and just doesn't know kind of where to start. In the last 5 or 6 years, what perspective have you gained on maybe some of the like the barriers to entry from a knowledge network or other perspective that you've seen either in Chicago or on the coast?
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you, no one is going to, the future 5 to 10 years, no one's going to go through what I went through and what people before me went through. The digital fabric, Twitter, I hate Clubhouse, but Clubhouse is one of those things where the connectivity between anyone who's important, quote unquote important, and has access to money and not, they're all right there. And so one of the things that I've seen over the last year or two, COVID was the first part, is just people who are using these platforms to connect because it's all they can do. Now there's a trust. Like in the past, the idea that I'd raise a couple million bucks without ever meeting you in person is insane. And now it's like, yeah, we're closing up a round. By the time this airs, it'll be a closed round for Songfinch. And I haven't met with any of these people in person. Like all of it happened digitally. And so I think that the downside of everything is that there's still this big disconnect between minority female and first-time founders and those who are not from the quote-unquote in community, where they have to figure out how to raise money. And it's going to be a struggle. And like, they're going to go through what I did. I think it'll be a little easier for them going forward because they can just go to Twitter and they can get intros and connect with people and create content that gets awareness and all that kind of stuff. But I still think the silos of like, you know, East Coast, West Coast, now Miami is hot, Chicago, Midwest still does not, they still have a lot of risk aversion. There is, you know, the only place that I had calls with people who wanted to meet me in person was Chicago. Like in our whole round, only place. And this is a place I live. These people have met me before. like it's crazy. So I think, you know, Chicago as an ecosystem has tons of potential. Cameo obviously was headquartered in Chicago to start, you know, they're all full remote now and Steven's in Miami, but like the company's roots are Chicago.
That's right.
Active Campaign crushes it here. Central crushes it here. Relativity crushes it here. G2 is crushing it here. M1 is crushing. There's so many companies. Tasty Trade got sold for $1 billion.
Clear cover, big round. Yeah. Clear cover.
So many really successful, high tech companies, particularly in media, marketing, fintech, in insurance, obviously in this, city. I think that we are really close to having a handful of founders who've got enough liquidity that they can start moving the needle. And if I had to pinpoint one thing that I think is going to be the future when we get into this crowd, you know, raising money, equity crowdfunding is a huge component. You can do 5 million now in a round, which kind of says I can raise from here to an A round almost without having to go venture, is where I had to knock on all the doors and try to like sell my way in and con my way in some regards and take out credit cards to make it work. These next round of founders are just pushing the door in. And if the door is blocked, they're just going to open and create their own door. And they're going to do it their way. And I really think you're going to see the last 5 years of really overpriced companies. They were part of the venture model that like had to do what they had to do to make the finance work for everybody. Some of them are going to get IPO through SPAC or whatever. And I think you're going to see some pretty depressing results out of some of it. Mm-hmm. Some will be good, but most I think are going to actually struggle. The future of these companies that are raising 100 million and more are going to do it where the founders still hold a lot more equity and they have a lot more control and the numbers aren't inflated for any purposes and they're raising because they can, not because they have to. And I think when you start seeing that, you're going to see a big, big difference in the end result, SPACs and IPOs and otherwise.
Well, but most of the technology field, they look for antiquated, like old school industries or processes that they can optimize through technology. Yep. And it's funny because like the venture capital kind of life cycle, from friends and family to seed to Series A and kind of so forth. Even some of the banks, like you mentioned, like you could do venture debt now if you have like certain criteria that you couldn't get before, like JP Morgan.
Yeah, I mean, the criteria is obviously hard. You know, we've looked at doing some of that stuff and it's like, you have to kind of have an A round. You've got to have a history of money and you've got to have some high name people on your cap table to support. But the point is still remains that the options are opening up for sure.
They're increasing over time. Yeah, I remember like I joined an angel investment group in 2016 and the only things I had access to were the three companies every other month that came through there. Yep. And then I joined another one and it's like the same deal, but maybe it's a different kind of network. Yep. And you're talking about equity crowdfunding and just like opening up the visibility to these. There's still that risk reward kind of thing. Yeah. And you probably see this more than anybody, given you talk to the startups like at the idea phase and as they're trying yep. to raise capital. If you're good, that's going to open up those options. But what about for the investor that, you know, thinks something's good and isn't? You know, like yeah. the risk is going to still be there. And like, how do we solve for that through compliance or visibility or otherwise? I think that's going to be a tough nut to crack for some of those investors.
It is. I think one thing that's going to change shortly, and how short, I don't know, is the increased liquidity for startups. I think you see it with Carta X, and I think Republic is on its way to doing this as well, whether it's through a token or through actually making a tradable exchange where you can trade shares of companies that have raised rounds that are pre-public, so private companies. You're seeing, you know, companies that are, before they do a SPAC or an IPO, they're having a tertiary round, whether it's Reg CF or Reg A, Reg D. And I kind of feel like these changes will make their way down, you know, to the bottom, where to like in startup investors, maybe not quite as tied in. You put money into a company, there is a liquidity opportunity there that makes it a little less risky. At the end of the day, you have to know what you're looking for in a founder. You have to understand, if you don't know the metrics of investment, then you have to be picking on companies that are in industries that you absolutely know, and just taking long shots because it seems cool or it seems interesting, I think is pretty high risk. So for me, you know, when I talk to all these different companies, like there are some of them I invest in like $1,000 or less, just because it's like, oh, it's a flyer in the energy space. Like, who knows? Most of the time I avoid it unless I see something that's like, I know that this founder has either been successful, will be successful just because of the makeup. And I know that the company's in a space that's clearly growing and is desirable. And the metrics to me bear out to where I can see how you're going to be able to scale this up. If it looks like it's a complete haymaker and you're going to go for broke on it, personally, I don't have enough money to just do that. So I think there are some investors out there who can, but I'm probably not that guy.
Well, there's different playbooks. Like in the public markets, there's the Berkshire Hathaway for sure. kind of value investing way to do it. You could follow the Reddit playbook and like go for the high flyer things that are heavily shorted. And I think there's a venture capital playbook that has kind of been around for a while. That's like founder, TAM, like there's certain kind of criteria there, but there's gotta be a playbook for super early, make a lot of bets. You're probably going to fail on 75% of them, but you know, the math works where this is a good investment and you might get 100x. You might come across a cameo through one of these platforms that you wouldn't have otherwise. So sure. it's got to mature, I think, a little bit over time. So let's just move to Chicago a little bit. So you hit on it briefly there, but as you acquired Technori, you started to scale Technori, you started to get access to folks in Chicago, folks on the coast and kind of otherwise. How have you seen Chicago grow ecosystem-wise over time? And maybe what are some of the positives and some of the gaps that you're seeing here?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, it's grown a ton over the period of, you know, the time since I came on and to now. I mean, there wasn't a cameo. There wasn't a lot of these companies that were raising in a billion. And, you know, I kind of think, you know, one of the things that I personally, hold on, my dog is going crazy. You're part of the show. My dog, Boo-Ray, is part of the show.
Boo-Ray, get on here. Give a shout out.
Come on over and come on. The show. Whichever way you want to do it. Sorry. You know, I think the Chicago component of this is we're battling risk aversion. You know, I think it shouldn't have been nearly this hard for Cameo to get going in the first place. Like it just, he had to knock on so many doors for an idea that, in my opinion, was brilliant from the get-go. I really thought that, you know, and it shows now that he's raised at a billion, but like $120 million in revenue. And I think that if you have something that's that big, that can be that big, not everyone can miss. You can't all be like, oh, I don't know. That's a media, you know, influencer company should be in LA. We've had this attitude that if it's media in LA and it's like fresh, it's out west. And if it's like fintech and it's very buttoned up Wall Street, then it should be out east. In Chicago, we're the fabric that puts it together. We're, you know, ag tech, insurance, SaaS, like we're all these nuts and bolts.
Sure.
And I don't think that's the case. I think the interest of the type of founders who are coming to you, which in Chicago are a very diverse group, because you've got the city of Chicago, but then you also have Northwestern and University of Chicago and University of Illinois and UIC and all these other, you know, schools, Loyola, that bring people from all over the world. And so Chicago has done a really good job with 1871 and other things to like start embracing technology in the community. Technori, I think, did a nice job of playing a role as from a media perspective on that. But there's still this like, oh, shucks. And it drives me absolutely nuts, because I think of like, I think I tweeted this out a little while ago. If I asked you what were the top, you know, industries in Chicago, media is not going to be one of them. And media, marketing, and fintech would be the top three. And then there's like insurance and legal and things like Relativity. But we need to get past this risk aversion. Unless you want every one of these whopper rounds being led by the coast and being led by Andreessen Horowitz and Google and the rest, then you got to step up. And I think the risk aversion, revenue first, I like it. I think it's the reason that our numbers bear out in Chicago, that we have higher return on investment. But what's the number? Like, would you rather have a $5 million return on $1 million or $100 million or $1 billion? And at a certain point, we got to step up and be, you know, more risky and take shots on big long game plays like Cameo and own them. And I think lastly, the other part of this is like, we really are and have embraced minority and female founders in Chicago's ecosystem. And it's something that's important. Longjump Capital just launched their kind of founder fund. But you know what? We do a lot of talking about it. We do a lot of consulting and stats. And at the end of the day, we are better than most cities in the country, but we're better at the bottom. We're on the floor. The whole world of investing is on the floor when it comes to investing in minority and diverse founders. And I think that that's something that Chicago, because of how we're built, could actually be a leader in. And I think if you started saying, not only do we invest in female minority founders, but we invest more money in them than others do, I think that's a huge part and would make us more attractive.
You mentioned some of the companies, Stephen Galanis and Cameo, M1, ClearCover,
G2.
You mentioned them, yeah, like basically getting an exit. And then I think you were kind of going into reinvesting kind of back into the community. We had Jonathan Ellis from Sandolphin Capital on a couple of weeks ago, I think the podcast launched. And he was talking about the concept of like activating investors, like taking some of those attorneys and doctors and manufacturing business owners that are just here. they're already here. They're probably investing in a 401k, and activating them and getting more access to the space, whether it's the equity crowdfunding play or more visibility and access. Is it a both, or, you know, how would you weight Stephen Galanis putting a bunch of money into the ecosystem when Cameo IPOs versus maybe activating some of this groundswell activity from an angel standpoint?
Well, it's a couple fold. One, Steven doesn't have to wait until the IPOs to put money in companies. You know, he's making money. He's taking money off the table, I'm sure. He's already investing. I know he is. He invested in Pipe. He invested in a handful of other companies. So I know that he's rolling. I think that when it's twofold with a Steven type. And G2, Goddard is another perfect example. Reverb, David Cult is another perfect example. These are folks who, when they see something and they signal that there's something here, other people flock to it. Mm. So the more these founders are investing in the seed stage and even the companies, like, this is completely off the reservation a little bit, but there was a story yesterday in TechCrunch about Stripe's investment in Ramp, which is a competitor to Brex. And there was this whole thing about Stripe is, no one has invested more money in other acquisitions and startups than a company at the stage that Stripe is at. They're not a public company. They were a nobody 5 minutes ago. And these guys have Bitcoin on the balance sheet. They're investing in competitors. They're investing in, that is the modern startup. Mm. The modern startup, mm-hmm. It is the founders and the startups that should have a balanced acquisition in it. Salesforce kind of started this whole thing. They invested a ton of money in HubSpot, who was a direct competitor. They invested and have partnered with ActiveCampaign here in Chicago. These companies are investment vehicles on their own. And I think that the more the conversation is brought up, the more exposure there is to the lawyers and the doctors and the dentists in the world. And I think equity crowdfunding and what we've been doing, signing up 50,000 lawyers, doctors, and dentists and regular Joe salespeople to become retail investors, I think all of that plays into it. I like Jonathan, and I like the way that they present that. And I've listened to a bunch of their clubhouses about it. And I think it's all important. Like, all this matters. But what I will say is human nature is that if you get a taste for something and you like it, you're going to want more. And the more you get and the better you get at it, the more competitive it becomes. And I think what we need is more of these people sitting out here. I'm in Glen Ellen, sitting out here in Glen Ellen, driving, walking by with their dog. I need these guys and girls to look up and be like, man, there's a whole bunch of companies like Cameo that I'm using every day. And I didn't even realize I could invest in it. How do I do that? And the answer to that is, you know, you invest in the stock market. So look at first look funds like Tribe Capital, look at, you know, Republic and things like that to just dip your toe in and start finding correlations. So you see things like Penn National acquires Barstool Sports in stock market. You see Penn National fly up, part of its gambling, part of its media. You see kind of the future of the way people are consuming everything through media. And so you see a Cameo, right? So you look at any kind of company that's public right now that has an impact on the music industry, the entertainment industry, HBO, Apple, all these things. They're, even the venture capital firms themselves, like Andreessen Horowitz, are doubling down and owning media channels. To me, I'm looking at stocks like that and seeing them perform at peak. And then I look down to the startups who are on the natural heir apparent, and I start investing a little bit in them. So if I have 50,000 to invest total, maybe I buy $10,000 in stock in two or three companies I think would acquire Cameo, and I put $20,000 in a seed stage Cameo. And that way I'm like all the way in the pipe. I just think the conversation needs to stop being this like venture capital Twitter, VC Twitter. It's everybody. Mm-hmm. Anyone with bucks mm-hmm. should get involved. We got to talk about it more, I think, is the thing.
So equity crowdfunding, I'm familiar in concept, but say I'm brand new to the space.
Yeah.
I jump on a Republic or some of the other platforms that you mentioned. What's the process from there to seek out investments, follow on investments, like the paperwork trail, like this, yep. as a new person, this is all kind of like hieroglyphics to me. And it's probably pretty scary.
Sign up, hook your credit card up. If you're Republic, you know, you fill out some forms on how much money you have. If you're accredited or not accredited, doesn't matter other than a certain price point you can go beyond and access to deals that are only for accredited, like a Reg D or something, which are companies usually ABC round. As far as the paperwork, it's usually a crowd safe. There are some ways, Reg A, that allow you to actually have direct stock or a percentage of revenues generated. So essentially kind of like a dividend in a way. Like Mr. Wonderful and Shark Tank would say, it's a royalty. Mm-hmm. Something like that. Generally speaking, you're signing up. There's a bunch of platforms. Republic is just the one that I'm most familiar with. You're going to sign up. Let's say you find a company, Gumroad just raised $5 million on it. So you're like, hey, I want to put $5,000 in Gumroad. Sign up, hook your account up, put your card up. You are agreeing to participate in a crowd safe, which is the same as a convertible safe, which is a very, you know, normal tool, instrument that to invest with. What happens is your pro rata amount of money that you put up relative to the total amount raised on that note will be broken up pro rata into a single SPV. And depending on whatever qualified financing and value cap terms are set, if when they raise money or get exit at that point, they convert you just like a normal safe. And if they have the right to buy you back or whatever, then, you know, 50%, you know, 150% return or something, that just happens there. All the terms, all the docs, all the paperwork, it's all held on Republic's platform or whatever platform you use. And you monitor it there. You just go on the app and you see what you've got your shares of. And they tell you if something happened where you have a financing, some sort of exit scenario. And the money goes back to that account and you can take it out and pay taxes on it like anybody else.
Listeners, check it out. Check it out. It's out there. It's out there.
It is. You gotta go Republic.co and just take a look. And that's not the only thing though, right? Because like you could be accredited and use it on AngelList, and Republic has like a private labs. There's groups out there like Tribe Capital that if you have to be accredited for that or part of an accredited group, usually. Where you can just get a first look. Like they're basically saying, you know, Republic raised 150 or something value round. And they're basically saying you can, like, we're committing $10 million to this round. And then they go out to people like me and like, hey, we're going to fill 7 million left. Like, do you want to put it? Like, there's a lot of ways to do it. And it's not all that hard to look up.
Switching gears a little bit. So Cameo makes sense to the layman. You know, a lot of people are probably kicking themselves saying, I probably should have came up with that. Spot Hero, same thing. Like, makes so much sense. Like, this should have been out earlier. It seems like a lot of the deals and founders that I'm talking to now, there's like this like deep tech kind of exponential growth in that sector that's a little bit more harder to comprehend, like the cybersecurity platform or the data warehouse that conquers all data warehouses. And I'm kind of scratching my head, like, if I'm not part of that tech ecosystem, I'm not an engineer myself, I'm going to have a tough time kind of figuring that out. Could be the next big opportunities, though. I don't know. And I, that's what I'm always looking to seek is like, what's next? You had everything going on the internet in the 1990s and early 2000s. You had the iPhone that came out, and there was a lot of startups that built on top of that platform, B2B SaaS. From your seat, what are you seeing as like now, plus maybe what's the next wave of opportunities?
So this is a mindset thing. You talked about like this deep tech, CISO, you know, blockchain, NFT, the whole thing. What we're seeing is the same thing that we saw 5 years ago and saw 10 years ago and saw 20 years ago and saw 50 years ago. You talk about Apple. You could look at it this way. It's like Apple has a phone that's going to become ubiquitous and there's going to be apps. And if you stop right there, you're kind of screwed because you're only going to be able to invest in stuff that's so obvious or terrible that there's like a very high risk or a high or low opportunity to actually succeed. When you should be looking at Apple as like, if I have a phone in 30 million people's, it's obviously a lot more than that, the hundreds of millions of people's hands, and they have access to the App Store and a good portion of them have this certain app, what does that third layer look like? What does it allow other people to do, given that they now have a technology, they have a network distribution, and they have the ability to move content or whatever the case may be? You got to look at the third layer. So when you look at Cameo, what you're looking at is, you know, Steven's going to love this because we've just been talking about him for like an hour. But, you know, what you look at is Instagram. What did Instagram really do? Not the start when it was just pictures, but when it started to go with live and Facebook hacked, you know, Snapchat and everybody else's tools. And you're like, oh, it enables me to connect with my favorite artists better. It enables me to connect with people in a way that is incredibly unique compared to the ways that I previously did. It was fan mail. It was writing stuff. It was sending, you know, weird stuff. I couldn't connect with them. Cameo looked at that and goes, the gap between the artist and the fan is getting thinner. With the Apple, with the phone, with the internet in general, with video being able to be stored, with Instagram and shareability and relatability, I believe in a couple of years, there's going to be a world where someone will go on an app and pay $50 to get Gary, it's like $250, but get Gary Busey to say hello to me. He thought that. He was crazy enough to think that. He wasn't thinking about the app. He wasn't thinking about the phone. He wasn't even thinking about Instagram. He was thinking about the next level.
That's right.
So what you're looking at right now, what you're looking out for is we're talking about crypto right now as we interview this, and I'm sure it'll be different by the time you publish it. Bitcoin's at 58,000 and change, was as low as 50, was as high as 59 today. And Bitcoin is going to be a conversation piece for a long time. Other crypto, Ethereum, the rest are all there. Blockchain is a tool. What does it mean? Why do people want to use it? Why is the ledger system different? NFTs are a result of creators having access to blockchain and tools like crypto and seeing liquidity and thinking, okay, this has happened. So here you are, right? Now we're thinking about tech investing. I'm not thinking about Bitcoin. I'm not thinking about crypto and blockchain and NFTs. I'm thinking about what's next. When someone puts my name on an NFT and sells it with a blockchain locked my name in and is using my rights to things, what's my recourse? How do I solve that? How do I keep myself from having security breaches? How do I stop? How do I fund things? How do I hold a wallet? How do I shop? So then you look at companies like Cash Drop and you're like, so Shopify disrupts Amazon by enabling anyone to have an Amazon shopping cart, essentially. Cash Drop is looking at like Shopify is old. I'm gonna Shopify. I'm gonna put it in a phone, in a text link, or on my Instagram feed, and there's your store. And then you start thinking about like, okay, how does the currency work? How do I store the money? How do I store the value? How do I keep it secure? So when you start looking at these next wave of companies, you're gonna see companies that are worried about VPNs, security, getting breached, getting hacked, that are also kind of banks and wallets, that are also non-fungible tokens. Like, what does the world of digital real estate look like? That's the future. And it's, you don't have to, you can like find a couple companies right now that are doing it and put in, and maybe they'll work, maybe they won't. They're still, it's real early. Like a year or two from now, that's when you're going to start to see $10, $20 million seed and A rounds for companies that are building that future. There's a couple outliers out there, but like you know, Fast is one that took some money from Stripe as well, that's sort of solving for that, you know, point of click purchase. These are all things that are solving or are building on top of a platform that we are just touching. We're like just barely in it now, right? So that, you know, that's how I look at it.
Well said.
And I think people need to look at the beyond the obvious. Start using your imagination.
Well said. I love it. I love it. Switching gears. We'll start landing the plane here on the podcast, but
all good.
I saw you were involved in Songfinch. Now, yep. I have a history a little bit with Songfinch. This is dating back to 2017.
A good history, I hope.
It was great. It was great. So Scott will talk about what Songfinch is, or maybe I will. So I was looking for a birthday present for a colleague of mine at the time, and Scott Peterson, he worked so hard, yep. Just had a kid and stuff like that. And I was like, we got to do something really, really interesting for Scott. So I came across Songfinch. I think they were maybe raising money or looking to get access to investors at the time. And yep. I'm like, I'm going to try this because this seems pretty cool. So essentially I typed some information into Songfinch about Scott, his background, his family, his business. And then a really, really, really good rap artist had created, I think it was maybe like a 2-minute song about Scott, probably turned it around in like 20 minutes. I don't know. But we played it in front of our entire team and he got the biggest kick out of it. He shared it all the time. So maybe I was an early customer. I don't know, but I had a great experience with it.
Definitely were.
So tell me about it. You got involved recently. Yep. I haven't bought a Songfinch since, but what's going on with Songfinch these days? How are you involved?
Yeah, so it's a great way to land the plane. We started off taking off talking about all the success of Cameo. Cameo launched on Technori stage June 2017. So did Songfinch. Same event. They pitched right next to each other. In fact, Steven's pitch for Cameo, he actually references Songfinch in it. And the concept is it's being able to have a personalized song created by an artist. And it started off when you were doing it with artists you probably wouldn't know. And now you're starting to get artists who are on Songland, The Voice, American Idol, have written for people like Tim McGraw and Jason Aldean. You know, we've got some incredible artists, tens of thousands, if not a million followers. These are real people with a real following. And essentially what it does is it like Cameo creates laughter. We create tears, happy tears. And, you know, since I came on, we've grown 1,000%. In 2020, we already are just about to hit all of 2020's revenue in Q1 of this year. And it's essentially, you know, a way for like, I love what we do for customers. I love the emotion that it elicits, but for the artists, these people who want to pursue music their whole life, they don't want to be bar backing and driving Ubers and shit to stay afloat. Their wives are going nuts. Their husbands are going nuts because the lifestyle is hard. And obviously COVID really challenged them because they couldn't tour and all that kind of stuff. But we create a marketplace where these people can make a livable wage, a livable side wage, if nothing else, doing what they love and practicing what they love, which is to write a song. And the way it works is you go on the website, pick out what genre, is it country? Do you know the artist you want? You select the artist, or if you want us to pick it based on your info, is it happy? Is it upbeat? Is it for an anniversary? Is it your wife? What's her name? Do you want it in it? Tell me some stories about your wife. Tell me some memories and tell me some things you want and make sure they're in the song. It goes to the artist. The artist will work on it, create a chorus, a melody, the whole thing. And in, you know, less than 7 days, they pop out a song and we've got 7,000 plus 5-star reviews. People love it. And the company, you know, to me is blowing up. We're closing a note round right now for a few million dollars. And we've got some major players from Craig Coleman, who's the CEO chairman of Atlantic Records, Sal & Co, The Weeknd. So to me, you know, when I started pitching this to VCs and it's like, I don't know, it's like Cameo, maybe we'll see. That was cool because we got some money in, but what really turned it for me is when I start talking to the artists and the artists like freaking out, like how cool this is. And you start getting music people who are in it. And now I feel like we're really rolling.
It's a two-sided marketplace. I think like I had a good experience with the person that I gave it to as a gift. And then I think, you know, you're creating opportunity for income and more exposure for some of this talent, like Spotify is huge. Like there's bunch of people that are just putting out really good stuff with good followings. Like, I think you're onto something for sure.
So like, you know, think about that though. Like if you're talking about Spotify, like an artist has to have 170,000 plays to get $100. They write one song for us and they make $100. YouTube, it's, you know, 60 something thousand to get 100. It's not easy as a musician. So I think we're creating that. And similar to Cameo, we're creating this experience where you and the artist have a bond. Like you get to have a song from someone who you actually like as a musician and they write the song for you and your wife or your daughter, your wedding, your anniversary, whatever it is. That is a connection that you'll have with that musician for the rest of your life.
I love it. I love it. For all the listeners, keep following Scott, keep following Songfinch, keep following Technori. Scott, for folks that just want to reach out or follow Technori or follow Songfinch, where can they find you guys?
Yeah, everything is at Songfinch, at Technori. And for me, at Katoon, Twitter is my favorite little disaster zone. So if you follow me at Katoon, I usually am pretty active on DMs and happy to talk to anybody about pitches or really anything. I'm bored, man. Give me something.
Scott, always a pleasure. We'll talk soon, man. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks, Tim.
Thanks, everybody. Hope you enjoyed the conversation with Scott Katoon. Make sure you follow Songfinch. Make sure you follow Technori. Listen to the Technori podcast. Really enjoyed our conversation there. I'm sure we'll have him back sometime in the future, so we'll get updates on all things Scott Katoon. Again, if you haven't done so already, follow us on Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn's Fireside Chicago page for any updates on future shows. Thanks again for listening, and we appreciate your support.